Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I am the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Today, my guest is Emily Nichols. She's a professional speaker, but it wasn't always that way. She worked as an engineer for several years before becoming a speaker, with her goal being to equip technical teams with human skills so they can be better problem solvers and leaders. I'm really interested to learn more about Emily's life as an engineer, her transition to being a speaker, and what exactly human skills are. Welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Emily.
Thanks, Neil.
So from the bit of research I did on you, I saw that you got a degree in engineering systems and computing. I've never heard of that degree. What does that entail?
Well, Neil, let me ask you, have you heard of systems engineering?
I have, but I don't even know what that means.
How about industrial engineering? Are you familiar with that one?
I've heard of industrial, yeah.
Yeah. So this is the kind of engineering degree that it is. The engineering school that I went to was fairly small. And so we got to take a lot of different subjects. It wasn't highly specialized. And, you know, the idea of systems is that you can be a multidisciplinary problem solver. So that's what the degree is about.
Okay. But I saw you didn't stop there. You ended up getting a master's in chemical engineering. What was the motivation to do that?
Yes, the second technical degree, what every engineer needs, right? I didn't take this second degree right away. I actually went to work in manufacturing for several years. And while I was working at the Quaker Oats plant in Peterborough, we had a guest speaker who came and talked to us about what we could be doing if we were collecting more data on our production systems. Now, at the time, we had a couple of pretty serious quality issues that we did not understand. We did not know where this was coming from. And to hear this researcher, this university professor tell us that we could solve this problem so much more quickly if we were collecting data, I knew, first of all, that I was going to get into data collection. And second of all, eventually, I wanted to learn all the things that he was talking about. So I started working on data collection in the plant. And this professor and his consulting company offered a 3-day training course in multivariate statistics. So I went and took that. And it wasn't enough. I wanted to learn more about it. And 3 days wasn't enough. But in order to do a master's degree, I would have had to move. And it just wasn't in the cards at the time. So it was just something that I filed away. And a number of years later, when a whole bunch of different variables in my life had changed, I called up that professor and I did not have any expectation that he would remember me, but he did. And he wasn't taking on any new students at the time. He was just retiring and winding everything up, but he did agree to take me on. So I was the very last student of Dr. John McGregor, and I got my degree in chemical engineering with a specialty in multivariate statistics.
Wow. I remember the last course I took in school was in statistics. I think it was biostatistics. I still get confused as to what a p-value is. maybe I'll get it right one day.
Yeah, you know, statistics was never easy for me either. And I think my undergrad degree only had one course in statistics, and I didn't see it as being particularly helpful. It wasn't until the master's degree, actually obviously I took several statistics courses in this degree, but the first one was cross-listed. It was a fourth year class and it was also a graduate class. And I really wish that course had been in my undergraduate degree because it was so useful. It was about practical statistics, how to implement it in manufacturing and design, how to run experiments. It was just a lot of fun. And the textbook was really helpful.
Nice. So you mentioned that you worked for some years in manufacturing. Is that the work that you did when you left school?
Yeah, I worked in manufacturing in a bunch of different product areas. So I started working for Quaker. Back then, it was part of the Quaker Tropicana Gatorade group. So I also had some opportunities to do some work with Gatorade and Tropicana. And at that time, the QTG group had been bought by PepsiCo. So, you know, we also had some colleagues in the broader world of Pepsi and Frito-Lay. So I had the chance to work on some projects beyond just our own plant. That was great. I also worked in electrical steel and in the production of high fructose corn syrup for a while. And that professor I talked about, after I finished my master's degree, I actually worked for his consulting company for a number of years as well. And so I worked with manufacturing companies and companies that were doing specialized product development when I was you know, as a consultant. So I've had a lot of different experiences with manufacturing, whether it was right down on the factory floor, whether it was project engineering, whether it was consulting as an outside consultant. And, you know, your podcast is about speaking. And I did a lot of speaking at Quaker as well, my very first job, because we were doing continuous improvement projects, right? And we were taking on some new methodologies, total productive manufacturing. And so they needed people to teach others how these techniques were going to be implemented in the plant. And I started doing that, I don't know, within the first couple, 2-3 years of my career, I was already, you know, teaching, facilitating internally.
Wow. But you left all of that behind, Emily. You became a professional speaker. What was the reason for doing that?
Well, if you go even further back, Neil, before the engineering courses, before high school, if you go all the way back to when I was, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 years old, what I really loved doing was entertaining people. In fact, there is documentation back then that said, Emily Nichols wants to be an author when she grows up. So I would say that I've gotten in touch with, you know, some of the earlier, deeper desires and found a way to combine that with my technical skills and extensive experience in manufacturing.
Okay. You know, I mentioned in the intro that you work with people on their human skills. What do you mean by human skills?
Well, you know, so often they get called the soft skills, right? And I just think that that term kind of does them a disservice. I think of connection, communication, creativity. I think of those as the human skills because it's really about getting back in touch with ourselves and being able to connect with other people. Of course, that's what I like to do from the stage now, but it's also really important, you know, one-on-one or in a small group on the factory floor. You really have to be able to connect with people. And it's something that I didn't really understand in the early years of my career. You know, an engineering degree, the emphasis is on your technical skill. It's about knowing things and being able to figure out things. And, you know, so naturally I expected that that was going to be the value I would provide to the companies I worked for. It was all up here in the head, you know? And I didn't realize some of the things that I was doing that were undermining the relationship. So for example, I was all about efficiency. I was always in a hurry to go everywhere. I walked fast, I talked fast, and that doesn't leave a lot of space for listening or noticing what other people are doing. And I didn't realize that I was giving off this impression that maybe I thought I was better than some people. You know, I don't think that, but my body language, the way I acted was giving off that idea. So, you know, I talk about the human skills. I talk about connecting with people, like really connecting with people and then communicating with them. And also about being creative. I really love the creativity piece.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking, Emily, it made me think, you know, you said that perhaps you came across as thinking you're better than others. Is that something that you came to realize, or is that something someone told you?
I would say no one told it to me directly, but I came to realize it through a number of things, a number of interactions that came up on the factory floor. You know, I can remember somebody accused me of stealing their idea. And apparently I had repeated something they thought was their idea in a meeting. And it looked to them like I was trying to pass it off as mine, which wasn't true at all. I just really wasn't aware that we needed to keep track of the ownership of ideas you know, I was of this more idealistic mindset, maybe that, hey, we're all in this together and it's fine. And it's not about who owns the idea and who really cares who said it first. Anyways, let's just get this done. And, you know, I really offended somebody. And that's, I don't think that that was the time when I thought, oh, people think that I think I'm full of myself. But it was through some instances like that, that I came to this realization. Yeah. Also, there's a safety factor. You know, you shouldn't hurry in a manufacturing plant. You should take your time. You should not be running up and down the stairs. And so people would tell me from a safety point of view, hey, Emily, you got to slow down.
Gotcha. You know, if someone had told you that others see you as think as you think it, you're better than them, would you have believed them?
Oh, probably not. Probably not. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why, because I thought that I was very perceptive about other people thinking they were better than others. So I don't know. Have you ever heard the acronym ERTW?
ERTW. No.
Engineers rule the world. Okay. That's what this acronym means. And when I was in engineering school, this acronym was everywhere and I hated it. I really hated it. I could see that this better than you ethos pervaded a lot of the social interactions. And, you know, I understand some of where it was coming from. I mean, we had to take more courses than any other degree program on campus. We had a heavier course load every term. So I like to joke, you know, the idea was, you know, we're better than you. We study harder than you. We're smarter than you. And damn it, we party harder than you too. But that was kind of the vibe, you know, it was, we're all in this together and we're going to make it, but with this kind of better than you vibe. And I hated that. I did not like that. Humility is a important value to me. It was important in my upbringing as well. And so if somebody had said, hey, Emily, people think that you think you're better than them, I would have been like, come on, you must be crazy. I don't think I'm better than anybody.
Okay. You know, Now that you told me what ERTW means, I think you're right. A lot of engineers probably do have that sort of superiority complex. And it's unfortunate because at some point, you're likely going to have to interact with other people. You don't work in a vacuum. You work with others. So if you come at people with that superiority complex, it probably is not going to end well for you. You're probably not going to be the person that moves up within an organization because you've rubbed people the wrong way. And then you're sitting in your cubicle mad because somebody else got what you thought you deserved. But it's all your fault. Look in the mirror, damn it.
Oh, yeah. And plus, I mean, think about teams of engineers. When you put multiple people together who have that kind of better than you, like I can't be wrong kind of attitude. Oh, man, it's just counterproductive.
Absolutely. So with the work that you do with your clients, what do you give to them? What can they expect?
Well, my favorite format is the keynote speech, Neil, and I'm happy to give a keynote speech wherever. So if it's on the stage, if it's on the factory floor at midnight, I don't care. I just really want to get out this message of, you know, human skills for technical people, understanding the value of connecting with other people, of communicating well, of tapping into your creativity. You know, I think that engineering leads us to this mechanical way of thinking of life. And as a process engineer, as somebody who studied and worked on optimizing manufacturing processes for so, so long, I found myself getting into this rut, right? I was optimizing everything in my life. Even if I think about how I would go to conferences. So Neil, I would study the program before going, right? You know, there'd be a keynote slot and then there'd be a section where there were five workshops going on at once. It wasn't enough for me to look down the list of five workshops and say, well, out of these five, which one do I think is best? I'd be thinking like, okay, but if I choose this one over here, then in that slot, oh, this one's offered twice. So I'm going to go to this one here. And I can go to this other one over there. Well, who do I know who's going to go to that one that I really want to go to, but can't get to? Maybe I can get their notes. And it was just, you know, on and on. And when I sat in a conference, it was in 2018 in South Africa, I heard the conference leader, founder, stand up and say, I hope this conference will be a joy to you. And I went, wait, what? Who goes to a conference for the joy? And I was already talking about human skills at this point, you know? So there's always more layers to uncover of self-awareness. He said, I hope this conference will be a joy. And I just thought, well, that is shocking. It was unsettling, really. I was like, oh, wait, come on. That can't be true. And I, you know, I've absorbed that, thought about it over the last few years and realized that optimizing your time at a conference the way that you optimize a manufacturing process, that's not the way to go about it. That's not the way at all. Some of the best times at a conference happen in the downtime or the snatches of conversation you have in the hall, if you slow down enough to notice people and talk to them rather than being in a hurry to get from here to there and take in all the content that you can, right? So that's also why I giggle when I talk about the fact that I have two engineering degrees, because yeah, yes, a second technical degree is what every technical person needs, right? Not really.
You know, it makes me laugh thinking about what you just said, Emily. You were told to slow down at your job in the manufacturing plant, and now you want to move fast to conferences too. It's like, damn, when are you going to slow down ever? And you know, I think you're right about it's interesting what the conference person said about it being a joy. And I think you're right. Whenever I had to go to conferences, it was because I had to go. It wasn't something that I chose to do, really. It was the company that I was working for said, go to this conference. So I wasn't there for joy. If I was doing things for joy, I'd be doing things that I chose to do as opposed to going to these conferences. But, you know, oftentimes if you go into them with the right mindset, they actually can be a lot of fun. Just like you said, in those downtimes in the hallways, talking to people, you know, learning and building relationships with others, that certainly can be joyful if you look at it that way. When I think of these conferences, it goes back to even why I started Teach the Geek in the first place. I used to go to these type of technical type conferences. You know, a lot of academic types oftentimes would be the speakers, and they would put me to sleep because they were very boring, and they would read their slides and they wouldn't look at people. And then the next person would get up and do the exact same thing. Hopefully you're not a fan of that. But when it comes to you putting your presentations together, do you have a process for it? And if so, what is it?
It's different every time, but let me tell you some of the elements. I always like to start with a story. And, you know, when we talk about engaging an audience, sometimes people think that we need to ask them a question, or we need to have people up and moving around or talking to each other or something. Story doesn't strike everybody as an interactive thing, but it really is, because as soon as you start telling a story, people's minds start putting themselves into the story. And so it's interactive in a way that is hard to understand from a mechanical mindset, right? This is where the human skills come in. So always start with a story. And then developing the flow, I like to do by sketching. Now, I mentioned to you that I like to talk about creativity, and this is something that I live too. Drawing is not something that comes naturally to me at all. But I find that it really taps into a different way of thinking if you start sketching out your message. And sometimes that's hard because drawing doesn't come naturally to me. So I start with mind mapping. So at least it's a spatial arrangement of words. And then once I get down some words on the page, I try to think about what pictures go with that. Like, there was one time I was trying to tell a story about something that was, I don't know, a little too formal, right? I had the word formal on the page, and I thought, like, what does that look like? So then it brought me to this image of a man wearing a tie to work. Like, hardly anybody has to wear a tie to work anymore, right? But I was comparing and contrasting the way we used to address people maybe a few decades ago versus now. And so I wouldn't have gotten to this visual of a person wearing a tie unless I was sketching it out as it went, right? It gives you more to work with. It gives you more content or ways to think about what you're going to say, which is important because not everyone is going to use the same vocabulary that you do or get the same message out of your words. And if you've been able to come up with a picture that embodies your message, even if you don't show it, even if you don't use any slides, the fact that you have the picture so clear in your mind, what you're describing is going to make your speaking so much better.
Yeah. You know, when you were when you you mentioned how some people start their presentations with asking a question or, you know, turning to your neighbor to talk. I hate that so much because now you're putting more work on me. I got to think about your question and then what my answer to it is. Damn it, I came here to listen to you. Say something that's useful to me. I ain't come here to work. And then when it comes to the turning to your person, turning to the person next to you and then talking to them, it's like, damn it, I do that when I want to do it, not because you told me to do it. It's probably the reason why I'm not an employee anymore, because I don't like being told what to do. So I really like your idea of telling a story, because now I can choose to engage, I can choose to listen, I can choose not to, but if you're engaging enough, I likely will. I firmly like stories as well. And that's definitely not something that I did when I first started giving presentations. I wasn't even sure it was appropriate, especially for technical presentations. But if you're speaking to a non-technical audience, especially, oh man, stories can be the difference between people actually listening and looking at their phones.
I would say even in a technical presentation, Neil, you got to figure out how to put in a story or a laugh or something. You know, I mentioned that I worked at Quaker Oats for a number of years before I went and did my master's degree. And when I did my master's degree, I was working on several case study projects that involved real data from the plant. So I was still in touch with some folks at the plant. And so when I got up to give this wasn't my thesis defense. This was presentation day for all the graduate students. So we were giving maybe half hour presentations of our work. And we've been there all day, right? I was at like 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the afternoon, right when people are starting to fall asleep. But I had a picture of myself, like where I had pasted my head on top of the Quaker Man logo. And, you know, it just cracked everybody up. And I started off with a story about working in the plant. And, you know, it was great. I think, and that was a presentation about multivariate statistics. So I think if you can work in a story into a presentation like that, any technical presentation should be able to have, you know, at least an anecdote in it.
Yeah. Do you ever get nervous before you give a presentation? And if so, how do you deal with your nerves?
Oh, I get nervous. Sure, I do. I would say the way that I deal with my nerves is by doing it more. But that sounds like kind of a trite answer, so let me unpack that a little bit. The thing is that I've done enough presentations now where I was nervous beforehand and they worked out just great, that I can think back on those times and know that it's going to be okay. And so even though I may feel nervous, I have the track record now to feel confident that everything is going to be fine. So when people say, oh, you just have to do it over and over again, yeah, that's true, but it's not so that you're not nervous. It's so that you get that track record and you can feel confident in yourself. And the other thing is, I think that a lot of people, probably technical people particularly, focus a lot on preparing the content. And of course, the content matters, especially if it is a technical presentation, but you also have to prepare yourself. And that's the human side, right? Here are the human skills again. How do you prepare yourself to speak? How do you remember that, you know, people are going to connect with you as a person, that the audience wants you to succeed? They didn't come there to be bored. They didn't walk into the room thinking, oh, I hope they bore me to death. I hope I fall asleep. No, they want you to succeed. So thinking about preparing yourself and knowing that you've succeeded in the past, I don't know. I think those are great ways to deal with the nerves.
You know, it's funny how you mentioned that when people come to see someone speak, they're not there to hoping that they do poorly. It actually reminded me of a conversation I had with a past guest, Dr. Darren Lapomi. He's a professor at University of California, San Diego. And as a professor, he often has to give talks at these conferences. And in the audience may very well be professors who are doing similar work. And so they'll ask you a question during the presentation, almost trying to kind of trip you up a bit because they're competitors. So sometimes, very rarely, but sometimes they actually do want to see you do poorly.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Sometimes there are some egos in the room. I remember going to ExxonMobil with my professor, Dr. John McGregor, and we were teaching together a 3-day course on multivariate statistics. So in this room were many people who knew more statistics than I did, right? I studied just this narrow branch of statistics for a specific purpose. But there were some people in the room who were PhD statisticians. So I was teaching a section and somebody stood up at the back of the room and said, "Oh, is this like the same as page 542 out of the Smith and Jones textbook or something?" I mean, I don't know. That question was way outside of my comfort zone. It made me really nervous. When you talk about feeling nerves, that's one of those instances that stands out in my mind as it made me really nervous. But you know what? It was no big deal. There was no reason why I should have felt that I should have known that or should have been able to answer that question. I'm not a statistician. I'm an engineer who studied statistics for a specific purpose. That's what I know. And hey, my professor's right there. He can answer the question. He has the PhD. So, you know, we have to not take ourselves so seriously, and we have to get away from this idea that somehow we're supposed to know everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I was talking to Dr. Lapomi, I said in some instances, if things get a little too heated, then you have to take them outside and beat them. Yeah.
Okay. Can you agree with you?
Words aren't going to work anymore. Now you got to put hands on people. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know about that. We can't condone violence.
Mm-hmm. You know, some people, they ask for it. There was no need to go that route. You know, you can be competitors, but you don't have to make me look foolish in front of my peers. So now we have to go outside. We got me in the parking lot. You got to see me now. Absolutely. So now, I have a question about your number one tip for the people who are tuning into this conversation about becoming more effective in giving presentations in front of others. What would your tip be?
My number one tip. I don't know. I think we've already talked about it. I'm scratching my head thinking about if I should tell you something that's original compared to what we've already discussed in this podcast, but I really think preparing yourself is the number one tip I can offer. If you just take that moment to get in touch with yourself, and what does that even mean? You know, I've taken some improv classes, Neil, and this is really what it comes down to, is being confident in your ability to improvise in a situation. And we all improvise. So when I say improv, it doesn't necessarily mean characters on a stage for a comedy night, right? Every conversation we have is an improvisation. What you and I are doing here is an improvisation. We haven't rehearsed this conversation. And so when I think about preparing myself to speak, it's feeling confident in that ability to improvise. Hey, I can do this. I'm confident, I'm creative, someone's going to ask a question, I will be able to answer it or refer them to another source or connect it to another part of my message or something. I don't know how it's going to play out, but it's going to be fine.
Excellent. This has been a great conversation, Emily. Thank you so much for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you?
People can reach me at my website, emilynichols.com. And I'm going to spell that for you, Neil, because you wouldn't believe how many different spellings of my name exist in this world. So it's EMILYNICHOLS, emilynichols.com. And on social media, my handle is ideasemily.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek interviews. My name is Neil Thompson, founder of Teach the Geek. You can learn more about it at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Emily.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms. We're on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.